It's extremely warm in the subarctic southeastern Bering Sea this year. It was warm last year, so we're seeing back-to-back years where it's warm again.
Ice retreat impacts on Bering Sea pollock. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, May 5th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, position cuts to the Department of Law.
Some of the less serious, non-personal crimes are going to get less attention.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. And by Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
The years 2002 through 2005 were bad for Bering Sea pollock. The biomass plunged during those years. Now a NOAA fisheries biologist says ongoing research points to two suspects, ice and fat, in league with each other. APRN's Liz Ruskin explains.
NOAA biologist Ed Farley of the Alaska Fisheries Science Center says the low pollock years were warm, resulting in little Bering Sea ice by May. The ice rebounded in 07 through 12, and so did the pollock.
But if we focus on this downward trend, that tended to occur during that early ice retreat period. That drop amounted to a 40% drop in available pollock catch, so that was a big issue. No one really understood why the pollock biomass was declining, but it was impacting the fishery.
Farley told reporters in Washington that the key Arctic ingredient is fat, and it starts low on the food chain. Farley says when the ice retreats early in the spring, it benefits small zooplankton that are low in fat. The pollock have to eat a lot of them to become fat themselves. But late ice retreat favors big, fatty zooplankton that Farley says make for bigger, fatter pollock.
If you're a fish or a marine mammal in this region, you're going to want to store as much fat as possible before winter so you have a better chance to survive.
If further research bears this out, it's bad news, of course, for the $500 million pollock fishery in the Bering Sea. Not only is the climate warming over the long haul, but we may be in the midst of a short-term warming trend, too. Farley says this is an early ice retreat year that looks a lot like the bad pollock years of 2002 through 05.
It's extremely warm in the subarctic southeastern Bering Sea this year. It was warm last year, so we're seeing back-to-back years where it's warm again. And last year we started to see, in our survey, a shift in that ecosystem back to smaller zooplankton.
Now, there's a lag in the effect on pollock. Just last fall, NOAA announced trawl survey results showed a big increase in pollock biomass. Farley says it would take at least three warm years in a row before he'd expect to see a decline in stock assessments. Further north, in the Chukchi Sea, Farley says they're finding a similar effect on two abundant fish in the food chain. Warm water turns out to be bad for Arctic cod, but saffron cod thrive in it. Problem is, the warm-loving cod have far less fat. So Farley says warm water means trouble for marine mammals.
So if you're an ice seal, you're going to have to eat 2.7 times more saffron cod to get the same amount of fat as you get out of one Arctic cod.
By the end of the century, Farley says, the water temperatures up north are projected to be outside the Arctic cod's comfort zone.
It's going to warm up to about 10 to 13 degrees Celsius, and that is a potential to be too warm for these Arctic cod, so they're going to be moving out, either move out of this region or not make it.
That would be bad for ice seals, he says, and for the polar bears that hunt them. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
The blob. That's the name climate researchers have given to a giant mass of warm water in the Pacific Ocean that stretches from Alaska to Mexico. They say it could be responsible for unusual sightings of marine life in the North Pacific. It may also be influencing North American weather patterns. KTOO's Matt Miller has this story.
then on, there's no stopping the blob as it spreads from town to town.
Nicholas Bond came up with the 50s sci-fi movie-inspired nickname for the huge, evolving mass of warm ocean water.
I started seeing this kind of very unusually warm water in a sort of semicircular patch about a year ago.
Bond is with the University of Washington's Joint Institute for the Study of Atmosphere and Ocean. He says temperatures down to a depth of 100 meters have increased more than 2 degrees Celsius since the fall of 2013. Bond says it's the biggest anomaly seen in the last 18 years.
It was a big event.
In a paper published last month in Geophysical Research Letters, Bond and his co-authors say it was caused by a lingering high-pressure system that normally inhibits cloud formation and precipitation. The high pressure over the eastern North Pacific blocked the usual parade of winter storms, diverted surface winds, and prevented the usual ocean cooling.
Also, the weird kind of direction of the winds meant that in the region of the blob, there was some kind of more warm water coming up from the south than usual to kind of make it warmer there.
The higher temperatures coincide with unusual bird sightings in the Pacific Northwest and catches of tuna, sunfish, and a thresher shark in Alaska. The blob wasn't the sole cause, but Bond says it could have helped divert frigid Arctic air to the Great Lakes region last winter. It also could have contributed to a dry West Coast and mild winters along the Alaska coast, simultaneously bumming out skiers and snowboarders and pleasing municipal managers overseeing street snow removal budgets.
And it makes much more sense that in the short term, the development phase, that the atmosphere drives the sea surface temperatures in this part of the world.
Rick Toman, a climate specialist with the National Weather Service in Fairbanks, says they're seeing those higher temperatures deeper in the ocean, not just at the surface.
That means that's not likely to change in the short term, say the few month change, that the warm water extends through a depth of the ocean, and that will take a while to change.
Bond calls it thermal inertia, and he warns that we may see the effects of the blob even through next winter.
So it's not due to climate change, but it is a taste of what we're going to be getting more of in future decades. I look at it as an opportunity to learn about what climate change is liable to bring us.
Six Alaskans are among the scientists and resource managers meeting at the Scripps Institute of Oceanography in La Jolla, California this week to discuss the blob. Over the last two winters, the blob has moved and stretched out along the western coast from the Gulf of Alaska to Baja, California. It's unclear how it will affect juvenile salmon now heading out into the open ocean and mature salmon returning to Alaska streams this summer. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Matt Miller.
Cuts to positions within the Department of Law could change the type of cases the state chooses to pursue in rural districts. As part of an effort to close a 6% budget gap, the department sent emails to employees stating 15 positions will be eliminated, with employment terminating at the end of the month. Rick Svobodny is the state's deputy attorney general. He says between this and last year, the full staff reductions are spread equitably across the state, but are most apparent in rural hub communities.
The cuts are more evident because, for example, in Dillingham, in Kotzebue, in Barrow, we all have gone from four people in the offices to two in the offices.
Other communities losing either attorneys, paralegals, or support positions are Sitka, Juneau, Bethel, and the Office of Special Prosecutions in Anchorage. 94% of the department's budget is for fixed costs like personnel and leases, with the rest going to discretionary necessities like travel related to cases. With less staff, Sabadni says prosecutors will have to be even more selective on what kinds of cases they choose to pursue.
We are not going to have as much time to spend on each case, and that does affect each case now. What it means is that some of the less serious, non-personal crimes are going to get less attention than they did in the past.
The department's budget was built on state revenues forecasting oil at well over $100 per barrel, and Svobodny expects more cuts in the years ahead. Critics of the state and federal government's presence in rural Alaska say there is already a law gap, with too few law enforcement officials based in hubs tasked with responding to incidents in smaller communities. Svobodny says the reductions will ensure the department is only pursuing serious charges and cutting out cases where there are civil alternatives to criminal proceedings. Six of the eliminated positions will come through attrition. The other nine staff members were informed of the reductions earlier this week. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the grizzly license plate is back.
We're anticipating that most people are going to select the bear over the last frontier now.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. And by Raven Alaska, connecting Alaska's business travelers across the state for more than 50 years. Find more at flyraven.com.
British Columbia's top mining official says Alaska will soon have more input into the transboundary mine permitting process. That news came today after a meeting with Lieutenant Governor Byron Malott. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld has the story.
British Columbia's Mines Minister, Bill Bennett, proposes opening more of its permitting process to Alaska officials. State government already has a chance to comment on environmental certificates needed for the mines to open. Bennett says he's willing to expand that opportunity.
We would propose to have Alaska also have access into the second part of a development of a mine, which involves my ministry and the Mines Act here in British Columbia, and the permitting for the actual construction of the mine and how water treatment is built.
The mines minister made that announcement after meeting with Alaska's lieutenant governor. Byron Malott is in charge of a state working group looking into potential damage to the Unik, Stikine, and Taku River fisheries if British Columbia mines release toxic materials. Those rivers begin in the Canadian province and flow through southeast Alaska before entering the Pacific Ocean. Malott says the state wants a larger voice in resource development and other projects along those rivers.
Now, certainly mines have the greatest chance of impacting water quality and the environment, but from Alaska's public policy and our sovereignty perspective, it's about what the water quality is that reaches our shores.
Malott says he's encouraged with British Columbia's commitment to including Alaska in a wider range of decisions. Bennett planned to hold meetings in southeast Alaska this spring to address environmental concerns. He never came and says he pushed those back until his agency had a chance to hear from Malott. He says those discussions addressed what he acknowledged to be legitimate concerns.
I think we have the beginnings now, a good foundation, if you will, to proceed with a discussion with Alaska on a memorandum of understanding that will capture the obligations that BC is prepared and is committed to taking on to meet the expectations of the Alaska government in terms of them understanding what is being proposed in BC and Alaska also having a hand in the assessment of these projects.
Bennett says his province has a similar arrangement with Montana. It covers the Flathead River with headwaters in southeastern British Columbia.
We have a memorandum of understanding that guides the relationship, and there is water testing done at the border as it crosses into Montana. And we would visualize a similar process with Alaska.
Malott's trip to the province includes meetings with mining industry and tribal representatives, including the BC Assembly of First Nations. He'll also meet up with a delegation of Southeast Alaska fishing, tribal, and environmental groups to tour the area around August's Mount Polly mine dam breach. Critics of Canadian miners and government regulators say not enough is being done to keep such a disaster from happening again. This is Ed Schoenfeld, reporting in Juneau.
Starting on Thursday, Alaskans will be able to get license plates with bears on them. The Division of Motor Vehicles has brought back a 1976 license plate that was originally issued for the United States Bicentennial. The updated plate features a grizzly reared up against a sunset backdrop. Right now, the standard license plate in Alaska is solid yellow with an Alaska flag in the center. DMV Director Amy Erickson expects the bear plates to be a popular alternative.
We're anticipating that most people are going to select the bear over the Last Frontier now.
Erickson says she plans to keep her Last Frontier license plate, but retired legislator Peggy Wilson, who sponsored the bear plate bill last year, says she plans to change hers immediately. The Wrangell Republican says the grizzly design is a conversation starter, particularly for Alaskans road tripping outside of the state.
When you were from Alaska, people just wanted to talk about Sarah Palin. And now this is something else, the license plate. It gives them another conversation starter.
Wilson says the original idea for the bear plate legislation came from a constituent who once had the original version on his car. That constituent will be the first person to be issued the new plates. Drivers seeking to swap their Last Frontier plates for the grizzly design can do so for $5. For more than a week, we've brought you stories that go out into the field for an in-depth look at Alaska's rural sanitation situation, a series we call Kick the Bucket. The series has examined how the lack of modern sanitation is linked to disease as people strain the limits of their clean water supply. And we have looked at the implications of decreasing funding and looming maintenance expenses in villages with a limited cash economy. Today, in Part 5, KNBA reporter Jacqueline Estes concludes the series by trying to look into the future.
Adolf Lupi of Tuntutuliak says his 2-year-old grandson Brandon is pretty much recovered from pneumonia after being medevaced to Anchorage.
I know my parents used to tell me that when their kids they'll get into sickness in their younger days, but when they get old, they'll be more immune to sickness.
In communities without running water and flush toilets, 11 times more children develop pneumonia compared to other Alaskans, and some develop complications that can lead to lifelong respiratory problems. High rates of respiratory and skin infections are due to the shortage of clean water needed for frequent hand washing. Federal and state funding is not keeping up with the need, and the situation is likely to get worse due to climate change. Colleen Swan of Kivalina says villagers had seen the effects on the sea ice that protected the village from fierce fall storms, but they were shocked by the tidal surge and flooding that slammed their small barrier island and carried away acres of land.
We know there is a huge problem. It's getting worse. It's going faster. It's like a moving train that's picking up speed. Our train hit in 2004, and we've been dealing with the aftermath of that. And so even if people are in denial, that doesn't change the fact that it's a reality.
Gavin Dixon with the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium says melting permafrost is affecting existing water and sewer systems, with flooding that's affecting water sources and high algae growth clogging filters.
We're having homes where we have connections to homes with Arctic pipes. Homes will settle and the pipes don't, so there's differential settling and that will break away from the houses.
In Alakanuk, the Yukon River is eating away at the shore, leaving residents wondering what will become of their water and sewer system. Village Safe Water Facilities Program Director Bill Griffith says agencies are working with the communities with the highest public health risks first, such as communities that have already lost critical elements of sanitation systems.
We've got communities that have lost their water sources or lost the water line that used to be on the beach that's eroded. That we're trying to get after those first, but it's almost like a triage situation right now. We don't have the funds to be able to do everything that we know is going to be affected over the next 20 years, so we're trying to work with the ones that are affected right now.
The consortium is also working on using new construction methods to save money. Dixon cites a building that was first built, then broken into modules for transport and reconstruction in a village.
This is going to be just over $1 million for this project here. Traditional methods of constructing an entire water treatment plant like we've done can be any upwards of, you know, $3 to $5 million, depending on the size of the community. Occoquan's fairly small, so probably been on the lower end of there. Another advantage of this is that, you know, in a community where they might need a water plant that is in danger of eroding or you know, they have to move, you can basically cut the pipes off here and move the water plant. You can't really do that with traditional construction methodologies.
Rural communities are also struggling to cover maintenance and operating costs. Dixon says a big part of those costs is fuel. He says spending some money up front would save more money later.
On average, it's about $80,000 a community to address about 60% of the energy reduction potential in those communities. It can save communities about $15,000 a year through little changes, working on your boilers, putting in new lighting, new controls, just replacing parts that have started to fail. It's all little things, but the benefit is pretty real for the community.
In Kotzebue, Manila Hospital Administrator Paul Hansen says modern sanitation will do a lot to improve public health, but he notes good health is also linked to jobs and to culturally appropriate care.
I think the biggest challenge that we face is really being able to care for ourselves. And when I say that, I mean not only just actually, you know, our daily habits and that sort of thing, but I mean developing our own workforce and having folks from our region taking care of folks from our region.
Meanwhile, Yukon Kuskokwim Health Corporation President Dan Winkleman has not lost hope that Congress or the state legislature will come through.
That's why it's even that much more important right now to get the policymakers out here so that they can actually realize that we're getting so close. We only have 4,500 more homes in the state of Alaska, and we're getting so close to closing that gap that even that much more effort and determination is needed now to close that last gap.
Innovation has been slow to come for rural sanitation in Alaska, and just as it's begun to appear, so has a dramatic reduction in state revenues. Everyone talks about planning for more resiliency in the face of climate change, but those who actually work with the problem speak more in terms of triage. Whether they will end up gaining ground or losing it remains to be seen. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Jacqueline Estes.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by Older Persons Action Group, promoting well-being for Alaska seniors and their families, including publication of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper. Membership information at 1-800-478-1059.
Troopers say a body thought to be an Akiak woman who died when a four-wheeler went into an open hole on the Kuskokwim last year near Kwikluk has been recovered. On Sunday, remains believed to be Sally Stone were found near the crash site. Her body is being sent to the state medical examiner's office for an autopsy. 27-year-old Stone of Akiak was traveling with 51-year-old Ralph DeMantle and 26-year-old George Evan in December from Bethel through a snowstorm. The ATV went into an open lead in the ice. Troopers say alcohol was a factor in the deaths. DeMantle's body was recovered in December, and searchers found Evan in January. Unalaska got its first taste of a record cruise ship season on Sunday. Around 1,000 tourists and crew disembarked from the Crystal Symphony to stretch their legs and do some exploring. And as KUCB's Annie Ropeek reports, some were surprised by what they found.
The Crystal Symphony arrived in Unalaska Sunday morning after 5 days crossing the North Pacific. And the early risers went straight to the local cultural sites, namely the town's two museums and the historic Russian Orthodox Church. Since it was Sunday, they couldn't go inside, but one man from Vancouver, who didn't give his name, found something to do in the parking lot.
To have the church with a bald eagle on the top is icing on the cake.
He said he'd photographed eagles in Alaska before, but Unalaska seemed to be a hotspot.
This is my fourth one this morning, and I've been off the ship for about 20 minutes.
This was the Crystal Symphony's first stop in Alaska on this cruise, though it's called on Unalaska in the past. Some passengers, like Jan from North Queensland, Australia, were surprised by the scenery.
It looks like the hills around have been painted. They don't even look real. You see, where we come from is tropical. And all our mountains are filled with trees and flowering trees and nothing like this. It's just so totally different.
Jan left behind summer in Australia for a cool, windy spring in Unalaska, and so did Liz Johnson and her husband. Before heading over to a crab boil at a local bar, they stopped in at one of the few local stores, Alaska Ship Supply.
Just looking around here for something to buy, a souvenir.
I'm buying a t-shirt that says, fill it and release. Nice. Rather than catch and release. I think it's fantastic. I love it.
Ship Supply store manager Eric Hansen says he sells a lot of shirts like that on cruise ship days.
We've seen a lot of people through here today, and hopefully later on we see the crew from the boat come in, because they usually get quite a bit just stocking up. Instead of buying t-shirts and whatnot, they're buying snacks and food for the trip, and more like what townspeople would buy.
Or like ferry passengers. The ferry Tustamina usually stops in Unalaska before the cruise ships start coming, but it's been delayed in shipyard and is now set to arrive May 23rd. That means the Unalaska Visitors Bureau is focused on cruise ships right now. On Sunday, board member Vicky Longan was posted outside the ship at the city dock, handing out maps and helping with transportation for passengers, mostly on school buses.
We're not geared to tourism, so they're seeing actually our lives.
Kathy Jordan is the executive director of the Visitors Bureau. She says her volunteer tour guides had to get creative when they ran out of things to do.
So they were driving them around down through some of the boat harbors and stuff like that, and then like back down so they could see the big crane and talking about what goes on around here. And they want to know the real life, authentic, what we do here. So it's really neat.
She says she talks about the sense of community, the jobs and the schools, but still.
They're interested in the challenges because we get on the bus and they're like, well, where's McDonald's? And, you know, well, don't you have a Costco? Things like that. So they kind of chuckle.
Jordan will be answering those questions a lot in the coming months. More bigger ships than ever are expected later this season, including one with 2,000 passengers aboard in September. In Unalaska, I'm Annie Ropeek with help from Liam Anderson.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. And you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Matt Miller and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Zachariah Hughes and Jacqueline Estes in Anchorage, Ben Matheson in Bethel, and Annie Ropeek in Unalaska. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reported from Juneau and Liz Ruskin from Washington, D.C. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Monica Goki is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977.
And by
Crowley, providing marine petroleum distribution and energy support services throughout Alaska since 1953, supporting business development while helping safeguard the environment. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. Alaska Children's Trust, working to prevent child abuse and neglect by encouraging all Alaskans to take small steps that can make a big difference in the lives of Alaska's children. Information at alaskachildrenstrust.org. This message sponsored by Alaska Children's Trust.
From resource issues to recreational activities, APRN brings you the up-to-date information you need for life in Alaska.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.